The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People Radio. You're joining us in our second hour. If you want to hear the first hour, you'll have to just go listen to the archive, because we can't possibly do that all over for you.
Thank goodness.
You'll find... Yeah, by the way, hey, Ray, were you taking notes? Like, could you do that over again? We've got that for you at wethepeopleradio.us. And tons of archives stretching back to October of 2010, believe it or not. We've covered all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I guess we should announce that if you have any ideas of programs or people or, you know, authors you've read or interviews you've heard and you'd like to hear more, shoot us a message. Go to wethepeopleradio.us and you'll find our phone numbers and email addresses.
Email.
Yeah, if you want to prank call anybody, prank call Bill.
Yeah, I'm good at prank calls. I'll return them as soon as I can.
I get enough of those at work. Bill's the one starved for phone calls. All righty. So we're here with Ray Haupt. Give us a little snapshot on your bio, Ray. It's always better if you do it than if I do it.
Okay. 33 years with the U.S. Forest Service. Forester by training. Went to school at Cal Poly.
I did not know that.
In San Luis Obispo. Also attended Humboldt State.
Me too.
Hey,
this is proof, you know, that like intelligent conservative people could go to Humboldt State.
There you go.
Go figure.
But I was only there a short period of time.
I was there a while.
I was studying logging engineering and economics. So,
so you were actually there getting an education.
Yeah.
I was an English major, and I was busy goofing off.
And then taught school for 4 years in a forestry program, and at the community college, it was College of Siskiyous and Weed and transferable program to Humboldt into forestry. And I don't know.
And now you're the elected county supervisor.
Yeah.
Dun-da-da-da-da-da-da. And people are really happy about that. I guess we should point that out. You know, a lot of our elected officials, you know, people are like, oh, all elected officials are bad. We need to get rid of everyone. Well, I'll tell you what, the people up there, if they tried to get rid of you, those guys would take them.
They'd have a revolt.
They would. They'd have a revolt. They're pretty happy about it.
Pitchforks and torches there.
Yeah, which is really weird because usually it's the other way.
Yeah.
But no, they're really happy. Somebody actually likes them, cares about them, and has information that can help them. What a good combination.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're all about... Our whole county is centered around natural resources, so...
Or the overabundance thereof and the inability to use.
That's correct.
Which is super frustrating. So, talk to us some more about the Clintons. What did they do to the, should we call it the forest industry? Actually, they mostly just messed up the Forest Service, which sort of trickled down to the forest industry, I guess.
that period of time... It's kind of interesting to go through that period and now reflect back on it. At the time, it was pretty painful. But as with all industries, there's a retooling, so to speak, every few years when there's new technology. And one of the things that was happening from the 60s through about the early 90s was that industry itself, the sawmills that support the industry, were retooling to small diameter material. And as a result, the departure that we talked about before was accelerated because the target was old growth. You know, I won't back away from that. That is exactly what the target was. But it wasn't nefarious as it's portrayed today. It was because fairly rapidly the remaining old growth on public lands, which is where the bulk of it was left, was not going to physically be able to be broken down into a product. Now, you know, we can make today's assessment on that versus back then, whether that's good or bad, but from an industry standpoint, the Forest Service had to catch up or go the way of the dinosaur with their products. And so as a result, you know, there was a targeted to old growth, and then the mills were transitioning out of old growth at that time, transitioning into the second growth material, because that was really the bread and butter of the industry that was coming on.
Yeah, you don't see those logs coming down anymore. There's just not.
Yeah, it depends what your definition of old growth is. Some people want to start at 10 inches, you know. I can grow.
Therein lies the problem.
Yeah, well, you know, to a forester, a 10-inch tree is something pretty temporal. But, you know, if we're talking, 40-plus, yeah, there's quite a bit of it left in the landscape and protected areas, but it's not the target of harvest anymore unless
because
it's in
they
the middle of a fire
it.
Salvage
right.
or something like that. Yeah.
Well, the Al Gore influence of all the tree hugging and all that,
yeah,
that's kind of gotten us to this fireplace.
Well, it's really thrown some monkey wrenches in the works. At the time, like I say, with this old growth thing, there was something called the War in the Woods, and it was using the spotted owl to shut down the industry, basically.
Which, that worked out well.
Yeah, it precipitated the Northwest Forest Plan. For which Bill Clinton put five principles in place. None of them have come to fruition. One of the big things that was known as the Grand Compromise was we're going to intensively manage a certain subset of the landscape intensively, and the rest of it would be in reserves.
So what does that mean?
Well, there's something called matrix lands, which had some old growth on it. It was supposed to be clear-cut and then managed even-aged management. That was kind of an antiquated thought at the time already, because we'd moved beyond all clear-cutting to something else. But that's what the plan was predicated on. And it was, you know, like some of the districts on the Klamath National Forest, the Salmon River District, it's only 3% of the landscape.
Oh, wow.
You know, and Scott River, one of the higher industrial landscapes, was around 15%. So in general, it was much reduced from where the agency was before, which didn't say that commercial activity couldn't occur on the rest of the landscape. It just had to be subordinate to whatever it was put there for, owls, fish, something else.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Compromise didn't work because that was supposed to end litigation.
Oh, well,
yeah.
If that was the goal, well, yeah, I think even my mom knows that didn't work.
That was one of the principles that President Clinton set forth, and actually it accelerated the litigation from that point on. The other insertion that the FEMAT team that put the Northwest Forest Plan together didn't really put into their final report was something called Survey and Manage. And Survey and Manage was an Al Gore thing. And it was largely an inventory and analysis of everything we didn't know anything about. Invertebrates, vertebrates, all kinds of critters on the landscape, even fungi and things like that.
So they're supposed to walk around and literally make like a catalog of what was there?
Yeah, and in some cases on some of these species, the protocols are such that you have to spend a certain number of hours on a particular size of a landscape to be able to determine its presence or not.
What?
Yeah, it's they're pretty convoluted. There's there's several hundred
species. You literally have to stand around in part of the forest
for a period of time? And move things around and observe.
To see if there's anything there you didn't know about before?
Yeah.
Wow. What's that job called? All the things I could think of actually would get me beeped on the air.
Well, the survey crews. Survey crews.
Oh, survey crews. Yeah, it's much nicer. We can say that on the air.
But, you know, I don't know the current cost of that. But,
for Lord's sake, if they're just standing around moving rocks.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of time? What are we talking, 5 minutes or 5 years?
Well, actually, it depends on the species. If you're blessed with some of the species, sometimes it's a 2-year protocol.
Salamanders or something? What are we talking about?
Well, some of the snails.
Snails?
Yeah. You have to look in two seasons. And the owls, depending on...
So while this is happening, meanwhile, mm-hmm. like back at the ranch, nobody's doing anything there. This whole area is just like locked down.
Well, what it did is it put into place something similar to the Endangered Species Act for species that aren't endangered.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's it really encumbered the working philosophy of the matrix lands that were to support that $8.5 million to like Siskiyou County with the outputs.
Wow.
And it, of course, with if you're looking for 30 species, and each species has to have a certain protocol And a certain paperwork filled out specifically for it. It just
and you
was
got to stare at it for 2 years.
It was a minefield of litigation.
Oh yeah.
You know.
So how do we get rid of that?
Well, repeal of survey manage is in the new bill.
Really? The 2647?
Yeah, the 2647. I saw that if AFRC is correct, it was...
What's AFRC again?
American Forest Resource Council.
There you go.
Sent out a newsletter, and it looked like it was maybe a floor addition once that bill reached the floor.
Nice.
I'm sorry to say I didn't think of that one, but it's, you know...
Good idea, though, huh?
It's brilliant because, you know, we already have those protections for those species. It's called the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, right. So we can't have, like, the Endangered Species Act and then the act that sort of looks for endangered species but doesn't call them that yet. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, it's ESA, the son of ESA, I guess.
Son of ESA. Hey, it was Shark Week last week. Yeah, what do we have? Son of... Oh, no, we had Bride of Jaws.
Bride of Jaws.
We always thought Shark Week was stupid, and then we watched it once, and it's like, ooh, actually, Shark Week's pretty fun.
Yeah, you know, the whole premise of the thing.
So, Bride of Endangered Species, what the heck?
The whole premise may have been good to sense how many of these critters we had, but if you're only looking in places you harvest, and you're not harvesting that much, you're never really going to know.
You're never going to impact them, so what do you...
Well, and you're really never going to know what the population is across the landscape, because you're only looking in certain places.
Okay, so...
Well, the Endangered Species Act now is really, I think, mostly used.
It's a hammer. It's not
exactly.
Yeah.
It's not about this.
So
critters.
How many people in the Forest Service are jammed up doing this kind of stuff versus doing things that are useful that the public might actually care about?
I was curious.
Is like half of them wandering around looking for... Mushrooms and large snails?
Large crews, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
All right, we have to take a break because now we have to bash our heads on the desk, and that's not going to come over well on the radio. Yeah, we have to have a moment. Duh. Anyway, you're listening to We the People Radio. We will be back with you. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a damn's busted.
It's like thunder, lightning. The way your love is frightening. I better knock on wood. Baby.
And we're back. Knock on wood. I forgot there was a song about that.
If you can find some in here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not really sure. We're surrounded by cords. Hey, okay, so give us that spotted owl deal. Because,
well,
you know, for all you people out there who hate us, but we're like a car accident, you can't stop listening, you know, because I know there's like the environmental set that just loves to hate us, because they call me periodically, mm-hmm. Which is how I know that. And... So, just in case you're thinking that all these protections are really actually important and they're doing what they say they're doing, and without them, we would be living on a moonscape, let's talk about the spotted owl.
Well, I think they were living on the moon if they don't know what that whole thing was about.
You hater.
I am a hater. I was impacted by that farce.
Yeah, it wasn't everybody who lived up here.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now how has this obsession with the spotted owl worked out for the spotted owl? Because that was the point.
Well, it hasn't worked out very well. And, you know, obviously there's very little harvesting going on of old growth anymore, as it was in the 80s when the spotted owl habitat was designated. But so if you have looking at the spotted owl population in northern in the Pacific Northwest under the Northwest Forest Plan, after 23 years, the spotted owl numbers continue to decline.
Oh, big shock!
And they're declining at 3% per year on a steady basis, at about a 40% decline over the last 23 years. And you know, logging isn't to blame for that.
Obviously, because we're not doing much.
No, not hardly any at all on public lands. Now, you know, it's different on private land, but they're still under Section 10 consultation under the ESA. But if you look at it, the biggest threat to spotted owls right now is two things, from what my research friends tell me. Number one is the threat of habitat loss from wildfire, and number two is the invasion of the barred owl into its habitat.
And isn't that like a spin-off of the spotted owl? Aren't they?
Well, it's a predator.
Cousins or
it's a
neighbors
predator.
Or
I don't know the. I'm not a...
Yeah, me either, obviously. Yeah,
I'm not a bird expert.
I just talk crap about them.
Bird expert.
Qualified to do that.
You want to talk to me about habitat? I can talk to you all day about that, how to grow it, how to maintain it, how to make it better, but...
Well, so hugging all the trees, we've got now, you know, just multiple times more trees on the landscape than we had before, mm-hmm. which is getting rid of our meadows, and as mm-hmm. you taught me a long time ago, with no meadows, you don't get any snowpack. So even if you get snow, you don't get you can't hold the historic snow back
sure.
because it sits on the trees and the bushes, and there's no place for it to pack.
So maybe we should talk about why do we have the fires we have today?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's chat about that.
if you look at the climate cycles,
sure,
if you will,
you mean the ones that God started, not the ones we were doing.
Yeah, and there is a change in climate and. You know, I don't call it climate change, but there's a change in climate because they're cyclic. And if you look at something called the wet period, wet-cool period, which we came out of about the early 90s, came out of that cool-wet period, it allowed trees to grow at much greater density and allowed species to exist in places where they normally wouldn't have grown, say, 200 years ago. Largely the true fir component that we see in the mixed conifer at a much higher density. And, you know, the research you've got on the webpage there, you'll see the four times the density as a result of that and cutting practices. But probably more important as well, coupled the same period of time, 1934, the Forest Service issued a letter that made it I don't know if it was criminal at the time, but an offense anyway to do range burning. And so that ended the previous, like in Siskiyou County, the previous 8,000 years of Native American burning.
That was in 1934?
1934.
Okay.
And then from about the Gold Rush era to 1934 was practiced by the range folks, you know, at the end of every season. So that was a cessation. If you look at the photo record from then to present, you'll see an explosion of trees beginning in about 1945, so about a 10-year period in the photo record. That coupled with the thinning from below now, what we've done is we've created a clone of trees across the landscape. We talked about the elimination of old growth.
Right.
Well, in doing so, what you end up doing is having very dense stands of second growth trees. And at the very time that they needed to be managed the most is when the industry was shut down on public lands. So you have very high densities of second growth trees with a much higher water demand than their old growth counterparts across the landscape at an even aged with intertwined, interlocking canopy that is predisposed to fire because we're coming out of a wet period. And we're artificially
sure.
densified, if you will, and predisposed to the fires we see today. Now...
So if we were going to, like, if you were going to actually plan to mm-hmm. have catastrophic wildfire,
yeah,
we totally did that.
We did it.
Yeah,
we did it.
We're all plugged in, ready to go.
Yeah,
we've achieved our goal.
So we have a predisposed landscape that during a drought, it's going to happen. It's physics.
Sure. And so for all those people that think, well, fire is a natural part of the landscape, and we should just let them run because it actually helps the forest.
Well, it is natural. And having taught ecology, I'll tell you that it is, but only if it's within the natural range of variability. And
what does that mean?
Well, what that means is you can't have...
Dr. Halp, what does that mean?
You can't have natural fire in a artificial landscape. Because
it was supposed to like rip through and get rid of some of the grass underneath and the underbrush and some of the bushes and you know, burn a little bark off, but not like turn the whole place into gray dust.
If you look at Eric Knapp's research and what he's done is reconstructed the growth plots of Duncan Dunning from 1930, about 1922 to 1935, I think, is when those were done in the Sierra Nevada. What you'll see is that what once had a variable carpet, if you will, of 25% openness in the stand, you know, it's all grown up to the same level now, and it's all filled in. So what, you know, the 25% openness is critical to both water yield from the standpoint of being able to pack snow in small openings so that you have longer periods of release during the year and higher flows in the summer, as well as it's a great behavior modifier for fire.
Because it gives little gaps where the
fire has to drop to the floor
instead
of running through the landscape and killing everything in its process. So we have historically on the fire studies in the Klamath National Forest and working with Carl Skinner, you know, you'll see a landscape that was 25% stand replacing historically. But that stand replacing was generally in the upper third of the landscape and not in the lower two-thirds of it. But now what you'll see is from valley floor all the way to ridgetop, you'll see 100% high-severity fire and complete mortality. And as a result of both drought, past cutting practices, lack of management, and fires just running.
And so with no management, the other thing we have to contend with that people have commented on, like in the chat room, and the thing we see all the time is the dead and dying trees.
Right.
So you have all this down timber in packed stands,
right,
which just creates, I mean, hey, anybody who's ever built a fire knows you take dry, you know, little brushy stuff.
There's two other components of that are really critical that most people miss. Number one is, in order for a fire to move through a forest without the destructive nature of it, it has to have canopies that are not interlocked. Because when we practice prescribed fire and things like that, we look at venting.
Oh.
And, you know, it's if you have a landscape where all your trees have interconnected crowns and a fire does run through it, it suppresses the heat below the canopy and cooks the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So there's...
That makes sense.
Yeah.
There's that aspect there in fire behavior in a pre-condition as well. Some other research coming out, too, is the ozone effects on forests are retarding the opening of stomata. Stomata where the tree expires, it's like your pore in your skin.
Okay.
Allows air and water in and out. But during high periods of heat during the day, the stomata have to close to keep the tree from dehydrating. Increased exposures in ozone from the research in Dr. Golke will show you that just a minor exposure like we see on the prevailing wind of a city will stop the stoma from closing for 48 hours. So what's that do? It leads to a freeze-dried, if you will, effect of the vegetation on the landscape, another predisposed effect of lack of forest management and air pollution.
Wow. I did not know that.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we're
getting really good at managing fire.
Well, maybe. I don't know if we're getting good at managing fire. We're getting good at spending a lot of money managing fire.
And when we come back, we have to revisit Spotted Owl.
Okay.
Just we have to revisit it quickly when we come back, but we need to take a really swift break. And you are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can.
We decided on the break we could see the forest for the trees. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. I will have the archive up shortly for those of you who missed the first half. But, okay, little side note on the spotted owl and the barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D. We have a commenter in the chat room who said that they are virtually indistinguishable. We've decided none of us are actually qualified to give some sort of a dissertation on that. But bottom line is they're close. They are close enough, and I have heard they're interbreeding.
Yeah, I know.
Which makes it a little bit bizarre that we're shooting the barred owls to save the spotted owls when they're interbreeding, because that would make them anyway.
Yeah,
biologists know best, though.
Exactly. So
we're going to fix it.
We've gone somewhere stupid with that.
I don't really want my grandkids to be robbed of the opportunity to see a purebred spotted owl. I mean, that's just wrong.
Or eat one. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no.
I heard they taste like chicken. Okay, back to the fire thing. What else didn't we, because we're here in our last half hour. It goes really fast, huh?
Yeah.
What are we missing? We talked about what about this national, you hear about it all the time, the NEPA and all that stuff, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Yeah.
And that just makes everything take 1,000 times longer. It is a...
It can. It doesn't have to, but it can.
It is a process. It's a process. I mean, it's a rule, but it's a process that they have to go through before they do anything on the forest.
Yeah.
And isn't that where the lawsuits all come in and all that?
Sure. Prior to 1973 or 4, my memory's escaping me, one of those 2 years when it was signed, the agency was largely engineers and foresters. That was it. We had some clerical folks, a few other miscellaneous disciplines, but the forest was ruled and, not ruled, but I mean, all the policy was written by and governed by that which foresters and engineers put together.
Mm-hmm.
The National Environmental Policy Act required an interdisciplinary team to have other resource disciplines come into the mix in the analysis of projects. And, we're kind of centered on vegetation projects here, timber projects, that kind of thing, but it pertains to anything. It really, if you're, any commitment of federal money for any program triggers NEPA.
Oh, wow. So you're tangled in that to do anything.
Anything, yeah. And, we complain at the Forest Service, but the military really has its issues with it as well. But it's put together as a supposedly a hard look at what you were doing, rather than a too disciplined look at what the effects might be. And I guess from my perspective, if the litigation I've been involved in was actually an effect that was occurring, I'd feel differently than if it were just an administrative challenge through the, what was analyzed and how, outcome not being detrimental to the environment, but maybe, like we talked about, survey and manage. I know of a lawsuit, the ONRC lawsuit from years ago. Part of that was because my predecessor on the district filled a form out wrong.
Nice.
So that's how that stuff gets interjected. So the NEPA process has public disclosure periods.
And it was supposed to take into account people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was supposed to be about people, and now it's almost
It was about the public's voice. And it was really clearly put together to disclose to the average person what was going on. It was not to pander to special interests. Which is largely what rule NEPA today and push it around because of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And for the agency to come to a objective opinion about the effects of a project that was about to be implemented, and an informing consent kind of a thing with the public.
So we have somebody who asked, categorical exclusions can be exempt to full NEPA.
They can.
Is that correct?
If the court would stop taking them away. Categorical exemptions are determined by the secretary under certain circumstances.
So what would be like an example of one?
You drive down a road, you see a snag, you see three or four snags that are leaning over the road, you cut them down. You know what the effect of cutting that tree down is. Rather than going,
it's not
going
to fall on the street.
Well,
it's not going to kill anyone.
There's really no environmental effect associated with that. So
right.
A CE is an exercise where it's an abbreviated form. You have to do. You still have to do analysis. You still have to do the ESA consultation piece.
Does that mean?
Well, what do you mean?
You got to call a guy who can come and sit there for 2 weeks and look for snails?
Still, yeah, well, study.
Are we talking about the snail guy?
Study.
Oh, yeah.
Back to the snail guy.
Oh, yeah, back to that.
That's America.
You have to, if you're, you have to do owl surveys unless you do that activity outside of the limited operating period. Which
if
is
it's a tree hanging over the street?
Yeah.
Over a road?
If it's done commercially, yes. Yeah. If you just cut it down, no. From a public safety hazard. But if you remove it and sell it, yes, then you have to go through the process. So the difference is, under the CE, you initially couldn't appeal them.
Categorical exemption?
Yeah, you can now, according to the courts.
So as soon as you file it, what, Center for Biological Diversity?
Yeah, and somebody.
These other guys, they come swooping in.
They can, yeah. Yeah. And like I say, they were designed for routine activity that had virtually no effect.
Right.
And but unfortunately, you can make money on those. And
if you sue.
Yeah, there's been several authorities given back to the agency since the mid '90s. The Bush administration did it at least once, maybe two times, if my memory is correct, and both times within. About a period of 2 months, the agency was sued, and the courts took that authority away again. It's just, like I say, it's an abbreviated process to do routine things in a timely manner.
But it doesn't sound like it's timely anymore.
Not if you have to go to NEPA, because it takes at least a year to get through an environmental assessment.
Good Lord.
At least a year.
And no wonder nothing gets done. So
yeah,
we've basically taken, I mean, as far as, like, if you just want to look at what?
I know what we didn't talk about.
What didn't we
the
talk about?
The effects of litigation on the budget.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty important.
It seems like a big deal.
Well, folks get pretty frustrated with the fact that, why do you listen to these people? You know, they're going to sue you anyway, that kind of thing. You hear that all the time. I did anyway while I was working. Well, the fact of the matter is, in the early 2000s, we talked about the budget being migrated upward. Well, when that happened, prior to that time, the Washington office mainly handled all the litigation costs for the agency as a line item in the national budget. You know,
right? But, and you guys handled,
we handled getting the job done.
Yeah, yeah. You handled managing the land and all that and the budget for that.
Yeah. Now, what's happened in recent years is that that cost of that litigation now comes out of the project funds to do project work. At the field level.
So that could be maintaining roads,
or
campgrounds.
Or a future timber sale, or any service to the public. So mm-hmm.
So it basically stops it before it even gets started in a lot of cases, doesn't it?
Well, but what it does is it's a disincentive to do anything other than whoever it is who's legally pushing you around. Because you end up...
if you don't do what they want, then you lose basically all your money.
Yeah, and you have part of your workforce unfunded, and you can't deliver the target or the services to the American public because it's coming directly out of your project funds.
So it comes out of... Okay, so if you, as a ranger, if you basically do whatever the environmentalists want you to do, which isn't even possible, but let's just pretend, if you did and your district didn't get sued at all, do you have more project funds?
You would, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that does kind of explain, there is kind of an incentive then.
Yeah, and it explains some of the wacky decisions and, some of the, the legal dance that goes on and that kind of thing.
But if they don't, Then they can't do the things that the public wants because it comes off their budget from their forest.
Yeah, but see, the public really doesn't have a hammer.
Well, right.
The courts do.
Right, but the public doesn't understand.
Right.
I mean, why the forest isn't providing certain things,
sure.
But they may not be able to.
Yeah.
And then how about the fire budget? So if your forest has a giant fire, does the fire budget come out of some magical printing press?
Well, that's a,
from the taxpayer, or does it come out of your forest budget too?
We can talk about that at several levels. Let's talk about the appropriation level. So,
okay.
My congressman's been fighting back and forth and on the fire borrowing.
Yes.
That occurs. And you know, with the budget being eaten alive by fire suppression funds, what happens is when the agency runs out of money at the national level to fight fire, they take it out of project funds. Well, that'd be okay if everybody were a firefighter, but they're not. So you have biologists and foresters that are actually working on service to the American public that now all of a sudden what they're doing is preempted.
Okay.
And so we put them in the service and support functions in fire to pay their salary because they can't work on the projects they were working on before because it was taken for fire. And this, of course, this always happens in the summer. And, you know, the fiscal year ends in at the end of September, and the new one starts October 1st. And the fire borrowing is always in the fourth quarter, which is beginning in June, which is also where the agency delivers all of its targets. So instantly when the fire borrowing occurs, there often is an offset of what should have been delivered that year because of no budget to deliver it. So you further ratchet down the outputs that were agreed to both at the congressional level and with the public in an offset there. That's why some have been advocating, like myself, that there has to be some firewall, if you will, between project delivery funds and fire suppression funds to protect the actual goods and services going to the American public.
So does that include funds for prevention, or is that just firefighting?
This would be under an emergency code. It would be firefighting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's turned, it's really taken the timber industry and turned it into a fire industry.
Sure.
Because you have a lot of the fires back in the olden days that we actually lived in, the fires were initially fought by people working in the woods.
Yeah, and that's really important to know, too. And the fire response thing, people are frustrated that the agency doesn't catch these fires. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. In reality, they do catch about 98% of them. They caught a much higher degree of those back earlier, primarily because early in my career, there was a logging crew putting the fire out before the fire crew got
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and they'd get on the radio and radio down that there was a fire.
Right.
And now, we're and decommissioning all these roads and making it impossible to get there. So even if you knew there was a fire, it's super hard to get there.
And there's nobody in the woods like there was back then, to speak of.
Now, what about the fire towers? I've got a question in here. Are they decommissioning those?
Locally, we have quite a few of them. All the ones that are efficient are still staffed.
Mm-hmm.
There were some old ones that didn't see much of the area that they got rid of.
Bill and I used to hang out at the fire tower. South Fork.
South Fork.
I guess regarding these 98% that are caught, if you take a woods crew that's nearby and they're on that fire in 15, 20 minutes versus an engine remotely located, it takes 3 hours to get to that fire.
Oh, yeah.
You can pretty quickly see how big a fire can get before an actual crew gets on top of that thing.
Well, there's always the big thing that they let them go, that they watch them and don't actually jump to put them out right away, and then all of a sudden Happy Camp nearly burns down and everybody's mad.
Yeah.
I don't think, I think as long as we continue to let the forest overgrow and be this perfect habitat for fire,
mm-hmm.
I think the public is going to continue to be mad because we're going to continue to have massive fires.
Sure.
We're like setting ourselves up for failure if we think that the fire thing isn't going to be happening. We'll always have lightning and stuff. Bob, how are we situated? Should we take our last swift break? You believe it? We've had you hostage in here for 2 hours. You didn't even know it, did you? It was pretty quick. Oh, you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Oh. Well, here's a classic. Bill's got his white pants on. Swing it, Bill.
John Travolta rocks.
Oh, dude.
We'll be right back.
recognize that part. I was like, where are we going? Who is that?
The Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
I remember that part right there. Not the video, though. Well, the video is disturbing. Don't look that up. We're not putting a link to that on the website. Wow. But you know, it is kind of funny. Fairly bad special effects. Do you want to look back at how bad special effects used to be?
Really bad.
Look up that video then. Okay. So, Equal Access to Justice Act. Originally started, good idea. Now it allows all the environmental groups to just, you know, sue the crap out of the Forest Service, and therefore nothing gets done. It sucks out all the budget, so they can't do the things that that would benefit the public.
Complicates the process.
Yeah, fouls it up. Okay, so dealing with that would be a good thing going forward. Sure. What else would be useful?
Well, you brought up the survey managed, or I brought up survey managed, mm-hmm. under the Northwest Forest Plan for us, and that's basically everything from Clear Lake, mm-hmm. All the way to the Canadian border, the spotted owl forest. Survey managed piece.
How do we get rid of the whole spotted owl thing? Can't we be done with it? I mean, if we're killing them and there's fewer now than before, now we really have to have the spotted owl thing? Or it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy? Or how long does... Like, if it's an endangered species, is it just there forever, mostly?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I figured.
Yeah. I don't know. You work for a congressman. Maybe you can...
Yeah, I'll go fix that. In my free time, we'll go handle that.
But it is an interesting thing in that a lot of the impetus for the enactment of the Endangered Species Act was actually to address, and I've done some research on this and taught it in school, is that it was put in place because in the 60s there were a lot of expiring treaties, international treaties on whaling. And the United States came up with part of the Endangered Species Act was to protect those species within our waters with a new set of legal things.
Well, go figure.
Yeah.
And that went wrong on us, too.
Yeah.
You know, every good idea is great until somebody else gets a hold of it and then...
No good deed goes undone.
Yeah, you know, strangles the life out of it.
Yeah.
Somebody, so, in our last 5 minutes, what are we missing?
What are we missing? The big... I guess the part that I didn't get to talk about was a little bit about the fire itself, good fire, bad fire.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing. Maybe I can address that a little bit. From an ecology standpoint, what we look at is we look at two forms of something called succession. Succession is started when a plant community is knocked back, so to speak.
Okay.
Hit with a punch. We call them disturbance regimes where we have fire. Some of them, like near the coast, are wind-driven systems that blow down trees. But it's a revitalization or a cyclic thing that happens in the natural world to enrich nutrients and recruit younger plants and start things over. when things are out of whack and you go above what we talked about, the 25% early seral in the forest, and you get whole landscapes. What you end up with is something in ecology called primary succession. In other words, if you have secondary succession, which is what we're always trying to do with forestry, mimicking our disturbance regimes like fire,
mm-hmm.
You give it a little punch, and within 20 years, it recovers to what it was before. That's the whole mm-hmm. goal of modern forest science,
mm-hmm.
And that's a productive ecosystem. If you hit an ecosystem, say with fire, and it goes back several seral stages, like to rocks, and then have to grass forbs, and then brush, and then trees again.
Right.
That's outside the range of variability.
And that's what the environmentalists now think is fabulous. You were on that tour, and they were looking at gray, scorched earth, thinking that this was beautiful and it'll come back.
And that's only normal in 25% of the landscape. And in the upper third, according to the research in historically on the Klamath National Forest. And that's real similar to the rest of the Sierra as well. So when you get things that are, 80% of the landscape or 80% of a burn that are that's outside what nature would have normally done.
Just scorch it down to nothing.
Yeah, you have other things at play when that happens. So at that point, your seed source is so far away, you don't get the you know, you don't get the revitalization. You have such a degradation, including, you know, I will say, too, the one effect that in the secondary succession is you still leave the soil intact. In the primary succession, those are typically reserved for, like, volcanic events and those kinds of things where you have complete destruction of all the flora and fauna in the soil itself.
Well, speaking of that, there was an article in Range Magazine.
Speaking of flora and fauna?
Yeah. Huh? Range Magazine did an article on Mount St. Helens and showed the contrast between Forest Service land that was they didn't go back in and replant and manage versus Weyerhaeuser land that they went in and replant. Yeah. And they're already harvesting that ground. And when you look at the aerial photographs of the difference, and there's a line. It's amazing.
We can talk about that someday because I worked there during the eruption.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to.
People have already said you need to come back because there's a ton of more stuff to talk about. So, so Pat will have to come shop again, and you'll have to come back and hang out with us.
I should have taken my 17-week forest ecology class.
I should have. This stuff's interesting, and there's a lot of it.
Oh, there's so much to talk about on this one. We need to have Ray back.
And especially as the summer wears on, you know, and the fires come and all that. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For popping in with us.
Happy to be here.
And thanks for listening. You've caught another episode of We the People Radio, and we will have your archive up in about 20 minutes. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.